Dr. Paul Elliott Cobbs, welcome. Thank you very much for coming in.
Well, thank you. It's always fun to be here.
Now, I have been told that when you open a performance, you flash your red socks.
Yes.
How did that start? Is that sort of a wink to the audience?
That's coming back to haunt me. You know? when I first started with the Everett Symphony 26 years ago, I was young and rebellious. And of course, you wear white tie and tails, and of course, black socks. You have to be formal. But I wanted to break the mold. I wanted to be adventurous. And so I dared to wear red socks. People would look at me and go, oh. So I thought I was going to be shocking. I thought the Everett public would say, oh, my God, he's wearing red socks. How could a maestro wear red socks? Well, they didn't. They actually liked it. And so at a point where the thrill of wearing red socks was gone, I went to black socks. And so then we took a patron out to say thank you for your gifts and everything. We had lunch with her. And I said, you know, you've given us such a generous donation. What can we do, make this gift, show appreciation for this gift? And she said, oh, no, I like the music. I said, do you have a favorite piece? No, whatever you program is just fine with me. She said, but there is one thing. I brought all my friends to the concert to show them your red socks, and you didn't wear them. And I was very, very upset. Well, needless to say, the next concert, the red socks were back, and they haven't been taken off since. Now, I don't know if you know it, but people have bought red socks that I've autographed. And so very often they'll flash their red socks at me.
Well,
so,
Johnny Carson had his own line of fashion.
You never know what you're going to start, so you have to be careful what you do.
It's hard to picture and to use rebellion in the same sentence with classical music. You think of it as being very stodgy and very conservative. You don't think of it as even the practitioners as being rebellious.
Well, you know, Beethoven was extremely rebellious. You know, everything was new at one time. And when Beethoven began writing, composers like Haydn said, oh, that's too noisy. That's too much ruckus.
Too many notes.
That's exactly right. So, a lot of the composers are also rebellious in their time, but after a couple hundred years, it seems a bit tame.
We're talking on Sound Living with Dr. Paul Elliott Cobbs this afternoon, and you're welcome to join us. You can join us by calling us at 425-303-9074, or you can join us on Facebook this afternoon. And if you have questions for Dr. Cobbs, please feel free to call and join the conversation as we are talking with him this afternoon. Were you scared 26 years ago?
I was scared. My knees would shake. And people didn't know it, but it's really nerve-wracking. And there were times when I was young, I was so nervous until I would look up and I said, oh, the symphony's over. I guess I did it right. So I look at the videotape. Yeah, I did it. But I was so nervous, it was hard to think. And maybe when I was in my 40s, I walked off stage once and said, you know, I heard every note. And somebody laughed and said, well, what do you mean you heard every note? Well, you know, when you're young, you're so nervous and you're worried about getting lost that you don't relax enough to just enjoy it and listen. But there came a point where in my conducting, I was experienced enough to just relax and enjoy it and listen to the notes. And so, yeah.
And are you still at that position where you can enjoy your performance as a conductor?
I've gone to the next step, which I can relax and enjoy it and then mold it a little bit, push it forward or hold it back and say, oh, that sounds good. So I'm thinking now. I'm not only hearing it, but I can think. And I say, well, let's push this ahead a little bit. Let's bring this back a little bit. Let's have a little more on top, a little less on bottom. So I'm able to relax, hear it, and mold it at the same time. And that's why conductors last for so long because it takes them so long to get to that point.
When you came here 26 years ago, did you plan to be here 26 years? Did you just see this as a place where you were going to stop and establish yourself and then move on?
Well, I never thought I would be here more than 5 years.
What happened?
Well, you know, the thing about it is I came originally as I was finishing my master's at the University of Washington. I came from Vienna. I was in Vienna at the Academy for 3 years, and I was conducting at the Church of England, and I had a chamber orchestra in Vienna. And so I was there for 3 years. And from Vienna, I traveled to Germany and Italy and France. But I said, you know, it's time to go back to the States. And I had to find a place to do my graduate work. And I had three choices, New England Conservatory, Indiana University, and University of Washington. And I said, well, you know, East Coast, no. Indiana, too much like Michigan where I'm from. And I said, but every single person I met from the state of Washington was very, very nice. So I also found out that the conductor of the Vienna Sinfonica was taking a job in Seattle. So I asked him, I said, if I came to Seattle, could I study with you? He said, yes. And his name was Rainer Middel. And so I followed him here, and I did my work at the University of Washington. So in the second year of my master's, the Everett Youth Symphony called and said, our conductor left. Can you send him one of your best students? And my conducting professor said, I'll send you my very best. And that was me. And I came up to do the Everett Youth Symphony. And it was supposed to be for 10 weeks. And 10 weeks turned into 30 years. So people say, why did you stay so long? I said, well, I like the people. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's about relationships. You know, you can talk about conducting the big orchestras, and I have. I've conducted many big orchestras, not just in the States, but also in Europe. But it's about the relationships you build with people that you see on a constant basis. So, and every time I decided to leave, the job that I was offered was with an orchestra that was at the same rank as the Everett Symphony. So I said, why leave? Because mm-hmm. the Everett Symphony went from an orchestra that was at the college as a class to one that could perform at Carnegie Hall and sell out and get a standing ovation and three curtain calls.
And a lot of that is due to your work because the symphony has been around 75 years, and they did not get to the Philharmonic based on their performances in those first 25 years.
Yeah, we were a team, and that's the point. We were a good match. You have to have a good match. Conductors and orchestras, either they are best friends or mortal enemies. In this case, we were best friends.
Talk a little bit more about you before we get into the idea of the music and things of that nature. And I'm curious to know how a kid from Detroit's tough neighborhoods
yes.
gets to Vienna.
Well, you know, I had a varied childhood. The neighborhood that I grew up in was a very, very tough neighborhood. In fact, you think about the ghettos of Detroit, even people from the ghettos were afraid to come into my neighborhood. And so that was a tough thing. However, there were two major influences in my life, and that was the church, because I was in the church choir, and I started conducting at the church, the Liberty Baptist Church. And people like Della Reese were there, and a lot of the famous people that you hear started out in the Black Baptist Church in a place like Detroit. And so I got musical experience in the church and in school. And so the minister and the choir directors and the people at church really pushed me. They said, you should go do this. And at school, you know, I had public school music, starting like everybody else with my little trumpet and violin and going to the boiler room.
You weren't the marching band, were you?
Well, not until high school, but in the elementary school. And the teachers kept pushing me. They said, you know, you do this well. This is something you should do. And so all through K through, well, grade 5 through 12, the teacher said, do this. And then about grade 11, I said, you know, how are you going to get to college? You know, my family was very poor and couldn't afford college. They said, well, how are you going to get there? I said, I don't know. He says, well, you know, scholarship. If you're good enough to get a scholarship. So I auditioned for scholarships, got them at the Wayne State University and University of Michigan.
With what instrument? Or
well,
what?
At that time, viola and trombone. And so I got scholarships to go. They put me through college.
A couple of disparate instruments.
That's right.
Viola and the trombone.
And viola and trombone are scholarship instruments. You need those more than violins and trumpets. And so while I was doing my undergrad in music, I had some conducting classes, and my conducting professor said, you know, this is really something you should do. You should do more of it. So I took their lead. And then my senior year in undergrad, one of the soloists for the orchestra fell ill, and I had been conducting a piece, and the conductor said, well, we're going to put you on. This is your debut. And I got my debut, and then from that, I graduated and became the assistant conductor of the Detroit Metropolitan, which was a very fine...
You were the youngest.
The youngest, 21 years old. I was just a punk kid. I thought I knew everything. And so for 2 years, I was conducting professionally in Detroit. And then the Detroit Symphony invited me to come and conduct an audition to be a resident conductor. That means you're kind of the number two person. So, you know, at 23, that's a pretty big deal. And I came in second place. And so I looked at the person who came in first place. He had just come back from Europe. And I said, okay, well, I've learned everything I could learn here. Time to go to Europe. And I wrote the professor in Vienna. He said, come. And I did.
Well, there is a long history of having to go to Europe to come back to the U.S.
And that's exactly right.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Elliott Cobbs on Sound Living. I have a quote that I want to share with you from, I believe it's from Raymond Harvey, who's music director of the Springfield, Massachusetts Symphony Orchestra. And he says, why should you pick a second-rate American candidate when you could have a third-rate European candidate as your music director and your conductor? So there's a long history of having to go to Europe first before
yes.
you should come back here.
Now, yes.
And one of your major influences, Dean Dixon,
yes.
went to Europe
That's
in order
exactly
to establish
right.
himself before he came back.
Mm-hmm.
And you grew up
Dean Dixon was my hero. When Leonard Bernstein had the television programs, the New York Philharmonic children's concerts, young people's concerts, I watched it on Sunday. And one day... Bernstein wasn't there, and there was a black conductor. Now, who had ever seen a black conductor? I was maybe 8, 9 years old.
This would have been about 61?
Yeah, somewhere in there. Yeah. And I said, I told my mother, look, there's a black man conducting the orchestra. Never seen a black man conducting the orchestra before. And so I just stared at him. And once I saw him do that, I said, I can do that. Even though I was in elementary school music, and I said, one day I can do that. It was amazing just to be able to see him do that. And he was respected by the orchestra. I watched his every move. And to me, you know, people think nothing of seeing a black person playing basketball or a black person playing football. But there was a time where the first one came, and you say, ooh, I never saw that before. So that's what Dean Dixon was to me. And I had arranged, when I was in Europe, to see him because he was coming to conduct the Vienna Philharmonic, and he died right before he came.
Oh.
And that was one of the big disappointments of my life because he was my first hero.
Well, there was a contemporary of his, Everett Lee, was also an mm-hmm. African-American, a black man who was in Europe conducting yes. at the same time. He returned to the United States.
Yes, exactly.
So slowly there were some role models for you.
There were role models. And the thing about Europe, the best place to learn Beethoven is Vienna. Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn, because they still play with that same interpretation. I'll give you an example. When I was at the academy in Vienna, there was a little old man who was in the conducting orchestra. They would hire people to be students and retired musicians in the conducting orchestra. So the conductors, the conducting students would have a chance to work with the orchestra. And we were doing Brahms' Second Symphony. And I was on the podium, and I was rushing through it. And this little old man looked up at me, and he said in a very strong Viennese dialect, "No, ja, etwas zu schnell, Zeit lassen, bitte." And that means, that's a little too fast, allow a little time. And so I did, and he said, "Ja, ja, jawohl." And so when I thought about it, he was at the age where his teachers had actually played under Brahms' baton.
Mm.
Now, who would know better how fast to take a Brahms symphony? That's hard to get in the United States. So it was like that all through Europe. And on the other hand, however, I'm finding that today, Europeans want to know more about American music. I went and did a whole week in Poland teaching young conductors how to conduct Copland, Appalachian Spring, and things like that. And so because we as Americans feel those rhythms and harmonies far better than the Europeans do.
Well, that was basically the whole emphasis of your PhD thesis with William Grant Still.
That's
was that,
exactly
that
right.
Authenticity of the ethnicity of the authenticity. And you set out to prove that a white orchestra could interpret an African-American, a black's music, like that being of William Grant Still, traditionally and to the original rhythms as composed by the composer. So this was just the reverse in Europe.
Then. Exactly, exactly. And with the William Grant Still, that's the piece that we played in Carnegie Hall that sold out the hall and got us a standing ovation and three curtain calls, because the last person to have done that symphony was William Grant Still himself 30 years previously in Carnegie Hall. And the great thing about Everett was that my thesis was, it's not a matter of ethnicity, it's a matter of culture. And culture is what you're exposed to. And so we talked one by one about those things that make black music black music. We talked about gospel music, spirituals. We talked about big band music, and most of all, the blues. We learned how to bend notes. We learned how to shade notes. And we learned about syncopated rhythms and how they're done traditionally. You know, growing up in a black Baptist church, you know all those things. And so what it takes more time. But a good musician, after working with them for a while, begin to do it with authenticity. And what happened was that you were able to hear the Everett Symphony playing with authenticity. They were bending the blues notes. And here you have these Northern European heritage people bending notes and playing blues rhythms and blues riffs with authenticity.
And did they enjoy it? Or?
Oh, they loved it. It just took them a while. I mean, they had to first get over the fear, and it had to not be mechanical. They had to feel it. At first, it was very mechanical, but they were willing to try. And then as they did it more and more, it became more and more natural. And then they did it with feeling.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Elliott Cobbs on Sound Living this afternoon, and you're welcome to join the conversation at 425-303-9074. I want to take you back to Detroit a little bit.
Okay.
Forgive me.
Yes.
But my image of you is in white ties and tails. That's my image of you, and I see you as Merkel, and I see you walking down the streets of Detroit carrying a trombone case. How did you deal with the peer pressure?
Oh man, that was so tough because in my neighborhood, it was a very tough neighborhood, and you had to be on your toes all the time. I remember when I saw these movies made recently about the gangs in L.A., I looked at the neighborhoods and I said, oh, that looks pretty good compared to what I had to deal with. But, you know, you deal with it, especially if you don't know anything else. If that's where you were born and raised, you don't know that there's something better. But it really makes you suspicious of people. You have to really be tough. You have to grow up very tough.
Well, how did you find out that there was something different?
Music. By being able to go to Cass Tech High School, which was one of the top 10 high schools in the country, through music. I was a music major in high school. And so that brought a whole new world to me by going out and in high school doing concerts all over the country. That brought a whole new world to me.
Well, let's take a look at that era for a moment, because you are probably about the same age as I. So you would have grown up with Motown.
Oh, yes.
You would have grown up with Elvis Presley, the mm-hmm. Beatles, all of these influences that are about as far from classical music as you can get. What was it that kept you from going rock and roll, that kept you from following your heritage as an African-American into the Motown sound and things of that nature, into the white world of classical music?
Well, you know, the thing about it is I loved Motown. And in fact, I had a lot of friends who were with Motown. And so I did that. In fact, I played in a 16-piece jazz rock band, played in a blues band. People don't realize it, but I played jazz and blues and did classical simultaneously all my time in Detroit. So I didn't choose. I chose to do it all. And when you're young and single, you can't. Needless to say, I wasn't married when I was in Detroit, but I would play blues and jazz until 4 o'clock in the morning somewhere, and then the next day I was doing a classical concert, and then on Sunday I was working with the gospel choir. So I did it all. I didn't say this is good music or that's not good music. Whatever touched me, I did. And so I can still name all the classic Motown tunes. I could name all the R&B.
Was there a time when you aspired to a career in pop music, where the idea of being a blues musician or a rock musician or a jazz musician was more attractive to you than classical?
No, it was all the same. In fact, my mother wanted me to go into the family business. The family business in my family was the ministry. So the idea of being a musician was certainly not discussed until I was in 12th grade. So I didn't aspire to do music professionally until my senior year in high school.
And who was responsible for that decision, or was it a decision that you came to on your own?
My biggest influence was the first black teacher in the Detroit school system. His name was Alfred Hickman, and he was from St. Louis. And boy, could he play saxophone. He was a great saxophone artist, and he could go on and on. But he encouraged me to take this path. Even though I had him in junior high, I saw him almost every weekend through the age of 21. And so he said, this is the direction you should go. Also, when you do a lot of different things, you have to also think what comes the most natural to you. And I sung in little doo-wop groups, and I played in big bands, and it was all good, but I excelled in classical music. And it was just natural. I excelled in that more than I did anything else. And I don't know why.
And what took you into conducting as opposed to sticking with the viola or?
Well, that same teacher, when he was out, you know, when he was sick and a substitute came, substitute would say, who can... Normally, it was a math substitute doing the music classes. And he says, well, who can lead the band? Who can lead the class? And my friend said, Paul can. So I get up and I wave my hands, and it just kind of worked out, and the kids loved it.
Did you know what you were doing?
No.
Waving your
hands? No, I didn't know what I was doing, but it was fun. But it became natural. And then when I got to high school, my teachers would have me do the same thing, but they would give me instruction. And then when I got to college, then it was serious. So it was just a natural thing. At first, it was just fun. But I took to it like a fish to water. It was very natural for me.
And then, of course, you had that experience with watching Dean Dixon on television. You seemed to intrinsically know what he was doing.
Yes. Yes. I could see his movements. You know, when you're young, you mimic. Before you can learn to do things on your own, you just mimic. And so I was mesmerized by him.
Well, there must have been people along the line that told you can't do that. You can't.
Oh, yes. I had college professors who told me point blank. He says, they would say, I will never give a black person an A in my class. Black people can't do this. And that's just right out there. And the racism was pretty strong. The racism all the way through I had to deal with.
And who do you credit for preventing you from becoming bitter and just angry?
Well, you know, I have been bitter. I try not to be, but which is difficult not to be sometimes, but it doesn't get you anywhere. So someone said, you know, you need to thank them for doing that, because what it makes you do is go home and practice more. If they said, oh, you're going to be great and you're going to do this, you'll get conceited. If they tell you can't do it, you'll go home and practice so much, and then you'll do it and just look at them. So that's your personality. When people tell you can't do something, you do whatever it takes to get to that point where you can, and you just look at them. That's the way you fight back. You don't fight back with words. You fight back with your actions. So, and it was a Jewish friend of mine. His name was Israel Edelson from Israel. He said, you should go back to those racists and say thank you, because you've made me a fine conductor.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Elliott Cobbs on Sound Living this afternoon. I have one more question for you with regard to your experiences in Detroit, and then I want to turn our attentions forward. You must have been, again, just guessing, 14 or 15 in 1967 when the riots in Detroit happened.
Oh, yeah. I was right in the center of that, and I watched it from our front porch. We didn't. You know, there were tanks going down the street. There were soldiers with fixed bayonets. There was a curfew. Things were burning all around us. Those were tough times.
A year later, Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated.
Yeah, and that was a very sad time, because I remember when I first saw Martin Luther King, everybody likes to talk about the I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. What they don't realize is that Washington, D.C., was the second time he made that speech. The first time he made that speech was in Detroit the year before. And I remember my father and mother taking my sister and I, and they said, well, we're going to march. And I had no idea what that was all about. And So I saw more people than I had ever seen in my life. We were marching to a place called Cobo Hall. And I saw these signs that said, "No more Jim Crow" and "Freedom." And I had no idea what it was about. But I knew that it was important because it was the first time I saw black people and white people and every people of every color walking together and holding hands and singing. And then Martin Luther King spoke. And he gave his "I Have a Dream" speech. So I heard it the first time he did it. And it was just fascinating to me. I was too young to completely appreciate what was going on. But I looked in the eyes of my father and the eyes of my mother, and I saw how... I mean, there were so many people crying as well. It was very, very emotional, very, very touching. And I'll never forget that day. It was sunny, it was hot, but people were determined all the way through.
And at age 15, there must have been something in you that in the wake of your experiences with the Detroit riot in 67, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, that you just didn't say... just chuck it all and say, this isn't, classical music isn't relative to what's going on in the real world. Look what's happening in the real world, and I'm shielding myself from it.
Well, you know, there was so much going on, you know, living in a very tough neighborhood. The average age expectancy for a black person, black male, was about 25 years old. You can either let it become so depressing until you give up or find something else. What I found in music was a refuge. So when I was depressed, when I was sad and I felt hopeless, I would go practice. I would go do music. My instruments were my refuge. And so I would get lost for hours in just music. And the harder it was to get through the day, the more it was necessary for me to just go close the door and play Bach. Because when I play Bach, nothing else exists. When I listen to Beethoven, nothing else exists. The whole outside world goes away, and I just feel the energy from those composers. And so that's what, between that and the church, too, because our church was like a big family, and we could also put the world away for that amount of time that we were in church. And that got me through, between the music and the church, and a strong family, because my parents were very... they were very strict, but they kept us safe.
Most people, when they have a hyphen in their name, have hyphen in the last name. You have hyphenated first name. How did that come about?
Oh, you can blame my mother for that.
She gets blamed for everything.
Yeah, well, in a good way. My father's name is Paul, but she didn't want me to be Paul Jr. So she gave me a second first name, which is Elliot. And people don't know this, but her hero was Elliot Ness, from Elliot Ness in The Untouchables. And so Paul hyphen Elliot was the first name to distinguish me from my father. That's how that worked out.
I was just curious. One of my favorite questions that's ever been asked was asked by Susan Stenberg, original host of National Public Radio. She asked during an interview with Leonard Bernstein, "Do your arms ever get tired?"
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Do they?
You know, especially when you're conducting ballets that go on and on and on. I remember doing 3 Nutcrackers in 2 days, and I had to put my arm in a sling because you get tired. But in more recent years, I work with a master at Tai Chi, and he taught me how to allow all the weight to go down into my feet. So the feet were heavy, but the head was light. So the feet on the ground and the head up to heaven, which relaxes the shoulders. And so you do it without a lot of tension, which is good because That's the first thing that goes with conductors, the shoulders and then the knees. And so I've learned to put the weight on my feet as opposed to my shoulders. Otherwise, you can't last long.
Do you lose weight between the beginning of the concert and the end of the conference because of the stress?
I've lost as much as 5 pounds in 1 weekend because you have to talk about the rehearsals too. So the rehearsals are sometimes more intense than the concerts, and then you do a series of concerts, and you're sweating all the time. You just, you lose all that weight from the exercise. Maybe that's why conductors live longer. I don't know.
Well, that's a theory. That is
yes.
a theory, and I've heard the conversation of the relationship between the strength and the stamina of an athlete and the strength and the stamina of a conductor.
Yes.
Because of the amount of work that's actually involved in there.
Yes, because at no time are you really not moving. Even in the rehearsals or even when the musicians are not playing, not all of them are playing, you're always moving. You're always doing something from beginning to end. So it makes sense you have to stay healthy.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Elliott Cobbs on Sound Living this afternoon, and you're welcome to join the conversation. You are, in addition to 26 years with the Everett Symphony, you are also conductor of the largest youth symphony in the country. That's the Tacoma Youth
yes.
Symphony. Is it difficult for you to shift your perceptions in listening to a rehearsal with the Everett Symphony and then trying to listen to the rehearsal of some middle school kids?
Well, I have to change my approach because with the middle school kids, they tend to be overly excited. if you're gonna jump off a cliff, they'll go right with you. With an adult orchestra, they'll look at you and say, "You go ahead and let us know how it lands." So normally, I'm holding back on the reins with the kids because they're overly enthusiastic. With the adults, I have to push them. I have to get them going. But once they're going, they're fine. So the approach is a little different. Same music, different approach. I can also be a little tougher on the kids.
I was wondering about that.
I can be very tough on the kids. In fact, the nickname that I've had for the last 20 years is Darth Cobbs. And there are all kind of stories about me throwing stands and getting mad and breaking instruments, which I really haven't done. But, stories evolve. But I just give them that look, that Darth Cobbs look, and automatically I get what I want. Now, with the adults, you have to be a little more diplomatic because the trombones may see you in the parking lot and take care of matters there.
Well, let's talk a little bit here in the final moments of the program about what's going on with symphonic music in Everett. We mentioned at the beginning of the program that you've got a new job. We've got the mm-hmm. Everett Philharmonic as
yes.
the symphony takes place. In your travels around the world, do you find it unusual for a community the size of Everett to have its own symphony orchestra and let it be here for 75 years?
Well, yes. We are very fortunate to be of this size and have a symphony orchestra performing at the level that ours does. How many symphony orchestras go to Carnegie Hall and sell out? that first of all, only the big ones do that. And to have an Everett Symphony do the same thing, coming from a small community, small relative to New York or Philadelphia, that's a big feat. That's really, really a big feat. So this is a very special place, and it's probably one of the reasons why I've stayed here so long. I always say, to me, it's all about relationships, because you have people who love it. You have people who come back every year after year after year after year. As long as they know what it's going to be about, as long as it's not snowing, they're going to be there, and they're very loyal. And I do pre-concert talks And they've been coming for 20 years, and we discuss the music and we have fun. So we've built relationships over the years.
Do you still find in, we'll use the term, the war horses, something new?
Always. You know, it's the wonderful thing about, there aren't that many wonderful things about getting older, but the wonderful thing about getting older in terms of conducting is you have these aha moments. You say, oh, now I know what this means. Now I know what melancholy means. Now I know what it means to miss a friend who just died. You know, you have insight that younger conductors don't have. The younger conductors are more concerned with getting the stick going in the right direction at the right time, whereas the older conductors, you know, you can do that in your sleep, is the deeper meanings of things. It's the emotional part. So now I'm getting into the emotional part of it.
And how does that translate to the music that the audience hears? How do you take one of those aha moments and let the audience hear that?
Well, the orchestra is my medium. And so I see this aha moment, and I do make the right movement to the orchestra to give me more or less of something or to stretch it out. And the orchestra does it because they're connected to me, and then the audience feels it. So I feel it. I do what's necessary to manipulate the orchestra to get that, to convey that emotion, and then the audience feels it. So it takes all of us to do that.
Well, talking a little bit about that in terms of what a community loses when they lose a symphony orchestra, as you know, there was the possibility for Everett. For someone who read in the paper about the problems that the Everett Symphony is having, they shrug their shoulders and they say, well, I never went to the symphony anyway. It doesn't make any difference to me. What does a community lose when it loses something?
It loses its soul. The symphony is the soul of a community.
Even if I've never gone to a symphony concert, it touches.
Even if you haven't gone to a symphony concert, it makes this a better place to live. Everyone loves symphony music. They just don't know it yet. You can watch football commercials and hear symphony music. You can watch.
Well, that's just because they don't have to pay royalties.
But it's, you know, the symphony is the soul of the city. And even if you haven't seen or haven't heard the symphony, it's something that you should. And it's up to the symphony to get you to come. Because our lives are surrounded by symphony music. And when you come to a symphony, you kind of come in touch with a deeper part of yourself. There are a lot of people walking around who are only in touch with the surface of themselves. A symphony concert helps them delve deeper, and they can feel things on a more spiritual level. A symphony is actually very spiritual to many people and to many of our symphony listeners. They feel a spirituality beyond the notes. And sometimes it takes a while, a certain age or maturity, to relax enough to feel that. But when you see tears coming down their faces when we're doing a Beethoven symphony, you go, they get it.
Do you think about the fact, does it, when maybe you're at the with the Tacoma Youth Symphony or maybe the Everett Symphony, there is somebody seeing you as you saw Dean Dixon?
I think so. I remember doing a concert with the Tacoma Youth Symphony in an elementary school in the Hilltop, Tacoma.
Not an area well known for classical music.
So as I watched these kids come in, I said, oh my God, because they were pre-gangbangers. You know, you tell in a year or so, they're going to be gangbangers if something wasn't done. So, but I did the concert and I narrated, And their eyes were fixed. And as I turned around and I was conducting, all of these guys, these tough guys, were mimicking me. After the concert, I made a point to go talk to them. I said, like the concert? I said, yep. You want to play an instrument? Yep. I said, what do you want to play? So one wanted to play drums. One wanted to play violin. Another wanted to play cello. So these are your pre-gangbangers, all looking at my conducting, imitating it, and wanting to play an instrument. And I said, I really hope you do, and I hope I get a chance to work with you.
Dr. Paul Elliott Cobb, and I want to again thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.